continuing with Alice Miller. It is also a part of poisonous pedagogy to impart to the child from the beginning false information and beliefs that have been passed on from generation to generation and dutifully accepted by the young, even though they are not only unproven, but are demonstrably false. Examples of such beliefs are, and as I was reading that, I was thinking, what we would add is that they are a superior master class. And what's the right word? Destined to be philosopher, state, statesman. But this is her list. Examples of such beliefs that are demonstrably false. One, a feeling of duty produces love. Two, hatred can be done away with by forbidding it. Three, parents deserve respect simply because they are parents. Four, children are undeserving of respect simply because they are children. Five, obedience makes a child strong. Six, a high degree of self-esteem is harmful. Seven, a low degree of self-esteem makes a person altruistic. Eight, tenderness, doting, is harmful. Nine, responding to a child's needs is wrong. 10, severity and coldness are a good preparation for life. 11, a pretense of gratitude is better than honest ingratitude. 12, the way you behave is more important than the way you really are. 13, neither parents nor God would survive being offended. 14, the body is something dirty and disgusting. 15, strong feelings are harmful. 16, parents are creatures free of drives and guilt. 17, parents are always right. When we consider the major role intimidation plays in this ideology, which was still at the peak of its popularity at the turn of the century, it's not surprising that Sigmund Freud had to conceal his surprising discovery of adults' sexual abuse of their children, a discovery he was led to by the testimony of his parents. He disguised his insight with the aid of a theory that nullified this inadmissible knowledge. Children of his day were not allowed, under the severest of threats, to be aware of what adults were doing to them. And if Freud had persisted in his seduction theory, he not only would have had his introjected parents to fear, but would no doubt have been discredited and probably ostracized by middle-class society. In order to protect himself, he had to devise a theory that would preserve appearances by attributing all evil, guilt, and wrongdoing to the child's fantasies, in which the parents served only as the objects of projection. We can understand why this theory omitted the fact that it is the parents who not only project their sexual and aggressive fantasies onto the child, but also are able to act out these fantasies because they wield the power. It is probably thanks to this omission that many professionals in the psychiatric field, themselves the products of poisonous pedagogy, have been able to accept this Freudian theory of drives, because it did not force them to question their idealized image of their parents. With the aid of Freud's drive and structural theories, they have been able to continue obeying the commandment that they internalized in early childhood, "Thou shalt not be aware of what your parents are doing to you." And she has a note at the bottom, "I didn't arrive at this insight until quite recently, and solely on the basis of my psychoanalytic experiences. I was surprised to find striking corroboration in Marianne Krull's fascinating book, Freud and His Father." Krull is a sociologist who is not satisfied with theories. She tries to combine knowledge and experience. She visited Freud's birthplace, stood in the room where he spent his first years of life with his parents, and after reading many books on the subject, attempted to imagine and feel what the child, Sigmund Freud, must have stored up in his mind in this room. Since the appearance of my book in Germany, other books have appeared in the United States that also point to Freud's drive theory as a denial of what he had discovered to be true. For example, Florence Rush's The Best Kept Secret, Sexual Abuse in Children, and Leon Schleff's Generations Apart, Adult Hostility to Youth. And then she continues, I consider the impact of poisonous pedagogy on the theory and practice of psychoanalysis so crucial that I intend to treat this theme much more extensively in another book, which she did, which I believe is titled Thou Shalt Not Be Aware. For now, I must limit myself to stressing how important it is that we all be aware of the effect of the commandment to refrain from placing blame on our parents. This commandment, deeply imprinted in us by our upbringing, skillfully performs the function of hiding essential truths from us, or even making them appear as their exact opposites. The price many of us must pay for this is severe neuroses. What becomes of all those people who are the successful products of a strict upbringing? It's inconceivable that they were able to express and develop their true feelings as children. For anger and helpless rage, which they were forbidden to display, would have been among those feelings, particularly if these children were beaten, humiliated, lied to, and deceived. What becomes of this forbidden and therefore unexpressed anger? And we're going to continue this, thinking this through next week, continue the reading next week. But I just have to point out that as I was reading, it struck me that thou shalt not be aware, that commandment, when she says that stressing how important it is that we all be aware of the effect of the commandment to refrain from placing blame on our parents, how important that is, not only because it's the key to our healing is to recognize that our parents were wrong, but also that it's key to our understanding the larger political reality when we understand through Bentham and through our observations that the parent is indeed the deputy of the state, and that when she says that the commandment, you must never question what the parent does, is transferred without question, without our thinking about it, to the state, and that that is in fact the point of it, is to sanctify, legitimate power, rule ad infinitum, a potent tool for reproducing power by training us to be obedient, to not question authority, which is why we needed Kropotkin. And thank you so much for listening. I am so very grateful that any hang in there through all the trials and tribulations, but I love you, lonely for you, and hope one day that changes. So until next week, thank you for listening. Peace. Facing fear, raise up love, raise up love. Facing fear, raise up love. Raise up love for women and children. Raise up love for the homeless and the poor. Raise up love for human rights, for all people. Raise up love, put an end to war.